And often during this process of giving things up and calming down, you often find yourself naturally watching the breath, because the breath is always there in the background. And when you do that, make sure that your attitude to the breath is just right. And the right kind of attitude is one where you see breath as like a friend, a spiritual companion almost, and you walk this beautiful path of meditation together with them. The breath is something that has sustained you for so long. Now it's like you can have a sense of gratitude towards that breath. With that positive perception, you're making the process far more suitable and useful. And we are now close to the end. And before we come to the very end, it is useful to just review the meditation very briefly. When you review the meditation, first of all, ask yourself how you feel now. And if you do feel a bit more at ease or relaxed or mindful, whatever positive quality has arisen, and ask yourself why that is the case. Try to understand the causes that support the meditation practice. Okay, so that's the end of the meditation.
Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Thank you so much, Ajahn.
Hello, Aya. How are you?
I'm very well. I was here all the time, actually. I was just messing around with the recording, which we had a bit of a glitch, so we missed the first part. Hopefully it will go all right.
Okay, very good. So nice to see everyone. It's quite nice with this technology, isn't it? You kind of just get onto the internet and then the whole world is right there. It's kind of very handy, very useful. Okay, so I'll just get started. Is that right?
Yes, please.
Okay, very good. So I'll obviously the kind of the thing that usually people talk about these days, talk about the problem with the coronavirus and all these kind of things, it's kind of an obvious topic. Yeah. And very often in life, I remember one of the nice things that Ajahn Chah said, and he said that to Ajahn Brahm, and he said it to many of the communities in Thailand where, you know, his monastery in Wat Pha Phong, is that when we observe nature, we learn so much. All the Dhamma is actually found right there in nature. And that is very powerful in a situation like now when nature is really giving you a hard time. And that's what the coronavirus is, just nature doing its thing. And then there's a massive opportunity for learning about something from that particular situation. And it's true that a lot of people, of course, are suffering from this, and it can be very difficult for people. But the interesting thing, and what is so useful about it, is it just takes a slightly different approach, a slightly different view. And then actually, instead of suffering from it, you make the problem into an opportunity for spiritual growth. And that is what is, of course, the kind of the point of the Buddhist teaching, is to understand the dukkha and the problems of the world, and then make that into something which actually gives rise to spiritual growth instead. And this is a very, one of the interesting things about the coronavirus, of course, is that it is one of an enormous number of problems that you see in life. You look at history of the world, it's full of big problems. And sometimes we can learn a few things from the large or the massive problems of the past. And I remember reading a few years ago, I read an interesting book. It was a book on the Second World War. And, of course, the Second World War was a tremendously difficult period for the world. It was such a massive war going on over pretty much all the continents around the world, and tens of millions of people dying, and it was just enormously problematic. And if you ask anyone today about the Second World War, everyone will say it was a terrible time with, you know, enormous amounts of suffering, and it was just awful and really, really bad. And that is the generally accepted view of what the Second World War was like. Yeah. And this is why this particular book I was reading was very interesting, because it was this book that was called something like, what was it again? Something like The Paradox of Happiness or something to that effect. And what this man, the point that he was making, this book was written back in the 1950s, so very, very soon after the Second World War. And one of the points that he was making was that the Second World War actually was a time of a lot of happiness for people. It's kind of absolutely paradoxical. He said that for many people, it was the most meaningful time, the most purposeful time of their life. And in one way, you can say, I mean, I'm from Norway, and Norway was very lightly touched by the Second World War. Yes, Norway was invaded by the Germans, but there was very little fighting going on. Very few people died, actually, in Norway compared to most of continental Europe. But still, there was something about the way he explained that the Second World War, paradoxically, was actually a time of happiness for many people. Why is that? The argument that he was making was that during the Second World War, there was a very powerful sense of meaning. There was a very powerful sense of standing together as a community against something that was very difficult. At that time, it was the invasion by a foreign power. Now it is the invasion by a virus. But similar kind of problem in a way. And because people stood together, because people had a sense of purpose, because people cared for each other, looked out for each other. There was a feeling of living for something. Actually, a lot of people had a strong sense of community feeling, a sense of all these positive things arising out of a very, very difficult situation. And he said for many people, it was the best time of their life during the Second World War. So when we hear about the Second World War, all we ever hear about is a number of people who died, the terrible battles they had. We hear about all the tragedy and the difficulties. And of course, that is a very important part of the history. But we very rarely hear about the other side of things, the fact that there actually was a lot of positive outcomes from that Second World War. It's very fascinating, and it shows you that how we often think about the world often is very lopsided. And we misunderstand often what actually is going on. And what that the point of all that, of course, is to point out that the things that matter the most in our lives are often not the external things, the material things of the world, even whether there's peace in our country. All of these external things are actually quite minor. It's just terrible how much we always focus on the external, how much we focus on the economic growth and our material well-being, etc. But these things are not the most important ones. And this is what this story from the Second World War shows. What really matters the most actually is our inner life. And if our inner life is rich, if our inner life kind of comes together with positive feelings and positive attitudes and all of these kind of things, then the externals actually don't matter all that much. It's very, very interesting. It is very interesting from a Buddhist point of view because, of course, our entire purpose of the Buddhist path is to develop the inner qualities and not to be so concerned about the external world. Because we know the external world is so unreliable. And this just shows you in a very clear way that that external world, actually, it really isn't anywhere near as important as it is often made out to be. So that was the first lesson from the Second World War, is that things are often very different from how we think about them. But it does show you that it is the inner qualities of human beings or any animal, really, any being, really, that actually matters in the end. And all the other stuff is actually quite superficial by comparison there. And the other lesson that was interesting from the Second World War is that, after the war was finished, then everyone was, of course, there was a lot of suffering also, despite the fact that a lot of people found some happiness. There also was a lot of suffering, especially for those who had family members who died. And that, of course, there were lots of people like that at that time. So after the war, there was this kind of agreement among all the powers that came together that never again we want to avoid this at all costs, to kind of repeat something like the Second World War. And out of that came the European Union and all these kind of things, trying to kind of create more harmony and togetherness. So never again, right? This is the idea. This is one of the things that happens during time of hardship. You get a new resolve to kind of live in a better way. And you can see that now already also with the coronavirus. You see people saying, this is going to change the world. We're going to look at things differently, and it won't be the same afterwards. Well, it never was the same in the first place, but that's kind of people forget that. But that's certainly that. It's always changing anyway. But anyway, that's how people think. And that is interesting. But what people forget, people forget how quickly we forget. forgetting is so fast. We forget the problem of the coronavirus. We forget what things were like. We say that this should never happen again, but actually it happens again very soon. And I'm sure that after the coronavirus crisis is eventually over, it will be a matter of a few years. Yeah, maybe a decade. I don't know how long the memory will still be there, of course, but it will fade away gradually. And it won't be long before it's back to business as usual again. This is just how human beings operate. Once things go well, once the world kind of is back on track again, and maybe it won't be so easy this time because we have all the problems of climate change and all of these things that may be a bit more lingering than usual. But still, we tend to forget the lessons of history here. And because we forget them, as soon as we're back to the normal world, we start indulging in the pleasures of the world and we become intoxicated by those pleasures, all these fleeting, empty pleasures that we can't control anyway. It's madness to rely on those so much, but that's exactly what we do. And then that intoxication that comes from enjoying the world makes us forget about the actual reality underneath all of this, which is always there, waiting to sprout back up again and come back up into our lives, always kind of just waiting under the surface. And we forget that so easily. And this is the problem. That was the problem with the Second World War as well. And this is what we're seeing, some of the results of that we're seeing right now in Europe with the UK leaving the European Union, which to my mind seems to be, from a Buddhist point of view, I should say, seems to be very, very unfortunate thing to do, because Buddhism is about harmony, it's about cooperating, about working together, and splitting up in this way. And it's not just the UK, it's actually happening all over Europe. Splitting up in this way is, to my mind, a very non-Buddhist way of thinking, because it's going to certainly lead to disharmony and problems down the track. So we forget so quickly, and this is the problem. And there is this saying that you may have heard that, some intellectual said some decades ago that if you forget your history, you're bound to repeat it or something to that effect. And the idea behind that is that we must not forget our history. We need to remember our history. But actually, it's just impossible. We can't forget our history. It's in our nature that we will always forget. We will always get intoxicated by life again as soon as things go well, and then we will forget again. This is just the nature of things. And especially from a Buddhist point of view, because the Buddhist point of view is that time is kind of cyclical. Yeah, time comes, you come back again to where you started out before. And of course, when you come back, you have forgotten in the meantime, almost by definition, what happened before. The very much the kind of Western ideas, come from Christianity and Islam and this religion, is that time is linear. You move towards something. There is a development towards a certain point. But the Buddhist point of view is very different. It's the idea of cyclical time. You go round and round, coming back to the same problems again and again. So it's almost guaranteed with that kind of worldview that the same problems will re-arise. And we forget about what they were like. So the thing we should do as Buddhists, that we should realize how easy it is to forget. And this is where the idea of right view comes in, because right view is that corrective that always reminds you of the problems and always ensures that you don't forget the realities of the world. So when the rest of the world goes back to the same old ways, the same old problems, and does things in exactly what happened before, and completely abandons all common sense or whatever you want to call it, then at least as a Buddhist or spiritual practitioners, we can try to remember the right view of the Buddha. And as we do so, hopefully we will not forget it, at least not to that extent. And sometimes we can even develop that right view even more strongly. But certainly now is a very good opportunity to instill that right view in us so that we don't forget again so easily when we come out of this problem down the track eventually. Yeah. So right view then is so important on the Buddhist path. And it is what allows us to remember our priorities, what allows us to remember our real values, what really matters in life, as I've been talking about now. But you can see now why it matters so much. But before I talk a little bit more about how right view relates directly to the coronavirus. And I want us to emphasize even more how important right view actually is on the Buddhist path, because it really is absolutely fundamental, and it's hard to overestimate how important it is. And I don't know how your practice is going, those of you on here today, if you are kind of, your practice is going reasonably well, you feel like you are moving forward with your meditation or all of these things, but it is quite common in spiritual circles and Buddhist circles as well, that you sometimes your practice kind of stops, it's like you reach a plateau, it doesn't go any further here. And one of the reasons for that, one of the ways of breaking out of these plateaus is to ensure that your right view is strengthened there. Yeah, because right view is there at the very foundation of the Buddhist path. And you will, so using right view is actually a very skillful way of breaking out of any feeling of stagnation in the Buddhist practice. And to see how important right view is, you can look at some of the doctrines in Buddhism, some of the big frameworks used by the Buddha. And for example, the obvious one to start with is the Noble Eightfold Path. This is the most important of all the ways of showing the Buddhist practice, yeah, from the very beginning to the very end of the path. And of course, what is so interesting about the Noble Eightfold Path is that it starts out with right view. Right view is the basis. And all the other factors of the Noble Eightfold Path develop out of that right view. And the Noble Eightfold Path is not just, you know, eight factors randomly put together, and you can kind of start wherever you like or anything like that. The Noble Eightfold Path is specifically said, I just got a message, I had to turn the light on, so I'll put the light on. I hope that is better. So the Noble Eightfold Path is specifically said to be a conditioned sequence, yeah? And each factor actually leads on to the next one. It's not just eight factors put together. And of course, when you have a conditioned sequence, each one leading on to the next one, then the first factor is going to be absolutely fundamental. Yeah, because the first factor is then the one which really allows all the other factors on the path to arise. So this is one very important reason why the Eightfold Path is so, sorry, why right view matters so much on the Eightfold Path. Once right view is there, once you see the world in a way that accords with how the Buddha saw it and accords with reality, then of course it becomes possible to make good decisions in your life. Yeah, you can start to actually act according to reality, which matters so much. Because if we don't act according to reality, if you act according to delusion or the silliness or not seeing things as they actually are, then there's no chance you're going to be moving in the right direction. And if you think about it, it's very obvious. It's just like in daily life. If you have the wrong information about something, if you're trying to get something done in your life, whatever that is, you're trying to follow maybe some instructions about something, but you have the wrong instructions, there's no way you will be able to achieve the result that you want to achieve, whatever that is. And you know that, with all the building work you've been doing, if you get the wrong instruction or the tool doesn't work, whatever, it's hopeless. You're not going to get anywhere. It's all going to be blocked. So we need to have that right outlook. So it makes absolute sense that right view should be at the very base of the Noble Eightfold Path. And then once right view is there, then your values, the correct values start to fall into place. You value that those things that are really worth valuing in this world. When your values are right, then you start to prioritize things in the right way. And this is really what the second factor of the Noble Eightfold Path is all about. Samma Sankappa is about you start to value things in a new way, start to aim for new things, prioritize new things, and then your life takes a different, it goes in a different direction. Yeah, simply because you now, what you value is different. And this then how this right view then kind of makes itself felt all the way through the Noble Eightfold Path, all the way to the very end of the path, the samadhi at the very end. So that is the idea of the Noble Eightfold Path. And then, of course, you have things like dependent origination. Yeah, these are all very important teachings in Buddhism. Noble Eightfold Path, dependent origination, absolutely core. things that you find throughout the suttas. And of course, dependent origination starts off with avijja, yeah, which is delusion, which is basically just another way of talking about wrong view. So to undo dependent origination, yeah, that whole sequence, to undo it, to, in other words, for this to not to lead to dukkha, but to lead to sukha, not to lead to suffering, but lead to happiness instead, you have to have vijja, a right view, at the very beginning. Yeah. That right view is what makes the whole of dependent origination unravel, and you end up with happiness at the end, rather than suffering. Yeah. So, yeah, and if you look at this through the suttas, you will find the same thing in things like the five spiritual faculties, for example. This also starts off with a saddha. Saddha is faith, but very closely related to right view. Yeah, you have faith in the right thing. It's in Buddhism, faith and wisdom are very closely related to each other. And so again and again, yeah, and I could cite many, many more examples. The gradual training is also very similar, very important framework in Buddhism. But there is one other thing which is also very fascinating, and that is that meditation itself is said to be based on right view. So if you go to the connected discourses on Satipatthana, Satipatthana, of course, one of the very important ways of thinking about Buddhist meditation, and sometimes Satipatthana is actually translated as mindfulness meditation. That's one of Bhantisiddhanta's ways of translating it, which is kind of, which actually is quite nice. And but what you find in the Satipatthana Sutta is that this mindfulness meditation is founded on two things. And those two things are sila, and sila is morality, good habit, yeah, good character, these kind of things, all the positive kind of character traits that we have inside of us. So that is kind of natural. You expect meditation to be founded on that. So that is actually very important, and that's kind of a talk in its own right, but very interesting to know, understand the connection between sila and meditation practice. But the other foundation for meditation practice is actually called ujjukha ditti, yeah, which is right, basically straight view or right view. So right view feeds directly into our ability to practice meditation. And this may sound, I don't know if that makes sense to you, but there is a couple of reasons at least why that is the case. So the first reason, of course, is that meditation practice and Satipatthana practice in particular, down the track, it is also about insight. Yeah, it's about understanding the world in the right way. Via samadhi, eventually, it's supposed to lead to insight. So if it's going to lead to insight, we have to start off with a degree of right view. Otherwise, it's not going to work. Yeah, it sort of makes sense. But there is another very important reason why right view or ujjukha ditti, straight view, feeds right into the meditation practice, because it is about your values. Yeah, if you value the world outside, then the coronavirus comes and you start to cry because everything is falling apart. Oh no, it's not working out, and everything is really terrible. And every time everything goes something goes wrong in your life, you become really distraught because you value that external life very highly. But if you understand the limitations of the external world and you start to value the spiritual path much more, and this is what we mean by right view here. Yeah, right view is very broad. That valuing of the spiritual path, it means that there is less interest in the external world. When there's less interest in the external world, it is easier to turn within. It's very obvious when you think about it. One of the reasons why meditation sometimes doesn't work out is precisely because we're not able to let go of the external world. We hold on to it, yeah? And the more we understand that the external world is unreliable, and now is a very good time to contemplate that, and we find our refuge inside, and then we can actually find that refuge inside, and it makes meditation possible. So this is one of the core reasons why abandoning our interest in the external phenomena is so important to make meditation even work at all, and one of the very useful contemplations that you can do now. So right view is so fundamental. That's such an important part of what this path is about. So if that is the case, then how do we think about right view? What is the right way of there's many, because suttas really have many different ways of talking about right jhana. And so what is the right way of actually using, what sort of right view should we focus on? And one of the good places to start is often with the Four Noble Truths. Yeah, if you look at the dependent origination, or you look at the Noble Eightfold Path, very often the right view is defined as knowing the Four Noble Truths, having an understanding of what they are, and also, of course, knowing them experientially as well. Yeah, this is one of the most important ways of thinking about right view. And the Four Noble Truths, of course, is they start off with the Noble Truth of suffering. Yeah, Dukkha Satcha is the first one. And if you look at that Dukkha Satcha, it has a lot of very interesting elements within it. And one of those elements is Vyadi Pidukkha. Vyadi Pidukkha means that illness or sickness is suffering. Yeah, and it's interesting. And this is where, to me, really get down to the kind of practical, pragmatic applications of right view. Illness is suffering. It may come as a surprise to people that why is there even a need to talk about illness and suffering? We all know that there is illness, so why is it in there? Of course, we know that there is illness, but we don't really know it that deeply. And that is precisely why we suffer when the coronavirus comes about, because it challenges our attachments to the world. We haven't really thought about that idea of Vyadi Pidukkha all that deeply yet. So remember that. Right view, we often talk about right view being, about rebirth and karma, and of course, all of that is very important on the Buddhist path. It matters enormously. But sometimes it's a bit intellectual. It's something you think about. Sometimes it doesn't really sink in that deeply. When we talk about illness is right view, actually, it becomes very powerful. It really affects how you think about life when you think about illness is suffering being an aspect of right view. So what does it do? Why is this right view? And the reason why it is right view can be summed up in this little story, this little thing which Ajahn Brahm always says. You may have heard Ajahn Brahm when he gives these kind of teachings. But Ajahn Brahm always says that when you go to the doctor, you should never say to the doctor, "Doctor, doctor, something is wrong with me." You should always say to the doctor, "Doctor, doctor, something is right with me." Yeah, so next time you go to the doctor and something is wrong, then see what the doctor says when you say that something is right with me, doctor. I'm sick today. Yeah. What do you think he's going to say? Is he going to say, "Okay, in that case," maybe he will say, I don't know what he will say, maybe he think you're completely mad or something. But this really is a very Buddhist way of thinking about the world. Yeah, something is right with me, doctor. And the reason why it is right is exactly the same reason why health is right. Because health and illness are opposite sides of the same coin. They are essentially, one cannot exist without the other. If the word health exists, it must exist in contrast to some other thing, which of course is illness or sickness. Otherwise it cannot be. So sickness isn't wrong. Sickness is just as right as health. So for that reason, you should never really be too surprised when you get sick. Yeah, it should never really be too kind of too strange. And once you get that idea into your head, then of course you tend to deal with illnesses in a far wiser and much, much better way. And I often like to think about myself. I think about myself because I had some close family members who died recently of cancer. And sometimes I think, well, gee, because I have the same genes. What does that mean? Can you inherit cancer, or is that just something? I guess part of it is inheritable, part of it is probably environment, probably a bit of both. But so I always like to remind myself that the cancers are probably right there inside of me. Not maybe, probably, but possibly. Maybe I shouldn't take this too far, but possibly right here inside of me right now, just waiting to come out. So I try to feel the body. Can I feel any cancers anywhere? Not really, I can't really feel anything, but quite possibly they are there right now. And again, this sort of just makes the reality of these illnesses so much more tangible when you think about life in this way. These things are opposite sides of the same coin. If you have one, you must have the other. They always have to go together. And this is the reality of illness in our world. And what that does when you start to reflect about illness in this way as an ever-present possibility, as something we can always come out, is always there in the background, it actually starts to affect how you think about the world in a couple of ways, a couple of very important ways. And the first thing that it does, of course, is that it tends to clear the mind of the intoxications inside. Very often we get carried away by being healthy, we get carried away by being alive, we get carried away by the pleasures of the world. Usually in the world we talk about intoxication, we talk about drugs or alcohol, but the Buddha expanded the number of intoxications almost massively, to include all of these things. All of these things are really intoxications. The things you get carried away by, you forget the underlying reality, which is always waiting to come through and come up again. So this is the first thing that actually happens when you remember illness. That tends to calm the mind down. It rids you of those intoxications, and it actually enables you to see the world straighter right away as a consequence. So this is already a very useful thing, that when you think about sickness in the right way. The second thing that remembering illness does, you can see that now, especially during this coronavirus period, you can see it brings out the feeling of compassion for other people. When you see the illness, an illness is not something that we are responsible for ourselves very often. Very often there are underlying things in society, viruses and things that are happening. We're not at fault for being sick. And because of that, it's a very powerful way of giving rise to compassion for people when you see these problems. So take this opportunity of the coronavirus to have more compassion for people in the world. And one of the things you can do to strengthen that compassion is to remember that one of the biggest problems in life, and why illness and all of these things are so recurring, why they are so problematic, and why we can't deal with them in the right way, is because we are deluded about life. We don't really understand what is going on. We get sick, and then you are healthy again, and you run around and rejoice, yay, healthy, so happy to be healthy. You forget about the underlying illness, always ready to come out again. Then when the illness comes back, you suffer even more because you forgot about it. And then it goes on like this, round and round and round, potentially forever, never really getting wise to what is going on, never really understanding this process of samsara, of the recurring problems of existence, of dukkha, re-arising again and again, not understanding the causes of these things, because you haven't really got a philosophy of life which is useful. And the vast majority of people haven't really got a suitable philosophy of life. So they are deluded. They're in the dark, running around again and again, meeting with suffering, meeting with illness, meeting with problems. And when you start to see the suffering of the world, and you start to understand that actually it comes from this delusion, this darkness, that we have no idea what is going on, people don't even often understand that there is a problem there, then, of course, compassion becomes even far, far deeper than it otherwise does. Sometimes you may blame people for their suffering, but when you understand that it comes from delusion, something we cannot control, something which is there deeply embedded in our psyche, then, of course, the grounds for compassion become far more powerful, and you can really start to have compassion for people. So reflect on the delusion in the world, the problems, the fact that it is people have no idea what is going on, no idea what the causes are for these things, and an almost complete inability to deal with these problems as a consequence. So this is the first thing that happens if you use illness in the right way. Even more powerful, and this is where illness really becomes, the idea of illness becomes very useful, especially as an aspect of right view, is that it starts to make the world seem far less interesting. If sickness is always there under the surface, if you never know when the cancer or heart problems or whatever might come out and might manifest in your body, if you have no idea about these things, and it's not only for you, but it's also for the true of all the people in the world that matter to you, that your loved ones, your family members, your acquaintances, your spiritual teachers, the Buddha, for goodness sake, the Buddha himself was afflicted by some of these illnesses, and he too had to die as a consequence. When you start to understand that this is the nature of the world, that illness is always there, you begin to turn away from that world. You take less interest in it because you understand how fundamentally flawed that existence is. And then what happens, instead of despairing, instead of feeling terrible about that, and if you don't have a spiritual path, of course, then you are going to feel terrible about these truths about life. And that is why you need something else. Yeah? Otherwise, you become an existentialist, like these French philosophers, and everything is just terrible and whatever. But actually, if there is something else that you can hold on to, and this is precisely what refuge in Buddhism is all about, is the idea that there is something there, a spiritual path, an alternative reality, an alternative practice that you can hold on to instead. And that is where true satisfaction and the liberation from all these problems actually are to be found. And this is the beauty of Buddhism. It gives you that refuge. It gives that alternative outlook, that ability to look at the world in a different way, to develop something inside of you that is not touched by this very unreliable external world. And that, of course, is your own mind. If you can develop your own mind and you can do something about that, then you are finding a refuge from all these external phenomena. Of course, in the end, even the mind is not an absolute refuge, because in the end you have to get insight into the mind as well, and you have to see even deeper into things. But it is a very good stepping stone, a very good initial refuge from all the problems of the world. Then further down the track, you can take it even further, and it can go even beyond holding on to the mind itself. But as a starting point, it is it's a wonderful way to go. And if you use the contemplation of illness in the right way, it will then push you onto that spiritual path, and it will enrich your life massively, and you will find happinesses, you will find contentments, you will find things in your life that are far more meaningful than you could ever expect to find in the material and external world outside. So your life becomes enriched enormously. And then you start to praise the coronavirus. You say, thank you, coronavirus. Yay, coronavirus. Thank you for coming into my life. Because even though you were dukkha to begin with, you turned out to be sukha in the long run. And this is really the right way of thinking about this coronavirus. So I think I can talk. I'll talk a little bit more. Because one other thing that also comes up, of course, that people are concerned about at this time, there's a lot of fear and anxiety in the world. Yeah, people are very worried about the corona, worried about what is happening with the world, and whether the economy is going to collapse, and whether the loved ones are going to die. And ultimately, we are also, I suppose, worried that we ourselves might die from these things. Yeah, even though the chances of dying are very small for most people, still, it is natural to have a little bit of a concern about that. So it can also be used as a death contemplation, yeah, or a contemplation about the reality, another aspect of right view, which also is found in the First Noble Truth. But before I say a very few short words about death contemplation, first of all, how to deal with the fear and anxiety. It is strange when these big things come into our life, the big sicknesses and the death, we often tend to forget about the Dhamma, the underlying teachings that we have been taught for so long. Yeah, I'm always a bit surprised that when even long-term Buddhists, they say, oh, they're worried about the coronavirus, how can I get rid of the anxiety, etc. But from a Buddhist point of view, actually, it is fairly straightforward, and that is to just remind yourself that your future is not really determined so much by coronavirus. Coronavirus is only a small blip on the screen. You know, it's like a small little blip on the graph of dukkha arising and then passing away again. Your future is not determined by that. Your future is determined by how you live. It's all about karma. It's all about your inner qualities. If you have good inner qualities, that is what is going to give rise to positive future outcomes, whether in this life or in other lives. And if the coronavirus actually does make us into better people, which it seems sometimes, then it is a blessing. Yeah, and again, it's this thing that we become kinder of, more caring, more understanding towards each other when we see all the suffering in the world. And to the extent that it makes us better people, actually, in one sense, it can be regarded as something positive. It is negative in one way, but it's also a very important positive aspect to that coronavirus if it actually makes us better people. So come back to very simple teachings like the idea of karma. Yeah, the idea that when you build up good qualities inside of yourself, of course, they are going to last for a long time, and you will carry those with you into the future as well. So this is how to, a very simple way of counteracting some of the fear and anxiety with the coronavirus. But very, very, very briefly about the contemplation of death. Now, you may have noticed that during the meditation I did before, I kind of used the idea of death very briefly. Yeah, I said, imagine that you are on your deathbed. And the reason why I did that is because dying and meditation are very closely related to each other. Yeah, it's not because you might be dead when you come out of your meditation. You probably won't be, but it's because the process is very similar. Yeah, the process of dying is one of letting go of the world. You have no choice anymore. You have to let go of everything. Meditation is exactly the same. Meditation is about letting go of things in the external world. So the two are very, very closely related to each other. And for that reason, if you find yourself to be reasonably successful in your meditation practice, if you find yourself able to find some peace in your meditation, and you're able to let go of that world a little bit, well, it means that very likely you will also be able to die well as well, because the process is the same. If you can let go in meditation, you can also let go when you come to the end of your life. And then your death is going to be an easy one. Yeah, you are already, your preparation is already there to some extent. And then we keep on preparing by going deeper and deeper in the meditation. So in a sense, you are already prepared for the dying. The converse is also true. You can then use the death contemplation to enable the meditation practice. Yeah, you know you're going to have to die, so you bring up that idea. You know you're going to have to let go of things in the world. Okay, so let go of them now. Yeah, don't wait till you're going to die. Now is your opportunity to test it out. And then it will enhance your meditation practice as a consequence. So death contemplation is very powerful and very useful. And even if you just kind of very briefly think about yourself on your deathbed like that, to see if that works for you, then that can already be very useful. And this can also be a powerful way of using the coronavirus problem to something positive on the Buddhist path. I should really have spoken much more about death contemplation because it is a very important part of the Buddhist practice, but probably it deserves a whole talk on its own because it is so fundamental on the Buddhist path. But please remember, yeah, coronavirus, the coronavirus that we have now is only one among endless coronaviruses. The coronavirus is just a metaphor for all the problems in life. Yeah, and there's always new things over the horizon. So in a sense, learning to deal with coronavirus also teaches you how to deal with all the problems in the world. So make the coronavirus, don't make it into a problem. See if you can turn it around. See if you can make it into something positive in your life. Yeah, even becoming a blessing, at least to some extent in your life. And if you can do that, you will gain so much. Yeah, and you'll become so happy. And right now here in Perth, in our monastery, I'm just exchanging some emails with Ayo Vimala the other day, just saying what a wonderful time it is to be a monastic. Yeah, because everything is so peaceful now. There's nothing happening in the monastery. Everything is shut down. Yeah, but it's the best time to be a monastic. Yeah? So I shouldn't become too flippant about the coronavirus, because I do understand many people are suffering. Yeah? And I don't want to make that suffering worse by being too flippant. But my point is not just that there are always upsides to any downside. And if we are wise, we make a lot out of those upsides. Okay, so that is all I want to say for now. So if we want to go on, we can go on to some questions or whatever, if people have some questions they would like to ask. Yeah.